I'm going to pass out by the time I get on this plane on Thursday.
My vacation is just going to be me sleeping in random locations in the south of France.
Welcome to The Late Set. I'm Nate Chenin.
And I'm Josh Jackson.
Today we are here in search of universal truth.
Oh man, that's so deep, Nate.
I mean, aren't we always?
Yes. Yeah, sometimes.
But especially so today, because that is the name of the album by our guest this episode, the pianist, composer, bandleader, award-winning live stream producer, Emmett Cohen.
Yeah, he's done a lot of stuff for not a lot of years on this earth, and I'm really excited by this record. You know, he was here in Philadelphia at the Kimmel Center, and we had an opportunity to bring him to WRTI Studio with Tavon Pinnicott on saxophone, and they did some beautiful performances for us, and it was a great opportunity for us to get into this album.
Yeah, they sort of made themselves at home in the studio, which was really, really beautiful. You know, Emmett has that, well, you know, Emmett's Place, which, if you're listening to this podcast, there's a good chance that you know all about it.
Yeah.
Emmett's Place has become a phenomenon. You know, started as a pandemic live stream. At this point is a kind of institution with a home base at the Berkeley Power Station. And it's just a testament to the personality that he brings to performance. You know, he's a good host.
He has a way of demystifying this all too, I think, mm-hmm. in a way that really feels welcoming to people who are not always the deepest nerds of jazz, but feel like there's a real way into the music, and it's a very welcoming presence. And also, he wears really nice shirts.
Emmett always is looking sharp. This is true.
And we have evidence when you visit our YouTube channel, Nate, at WRTI Music. He and Tavon did the Universal Truth Suite from the recording as a duo in our studio, and you can see that at WRTI Music on YouTube.
I was wondering, Josh, what is your history with Emmett? How far back do you go with him? Because he's, you know, he's 36 now, and he's been on the scene for quite a while.
I think the closest connection I have with him is through the American Pianist Association when we did the performances and stuff at the Rubin Museum in New York. Mm-hmm. And that was the chance that I really got to spend a lot more time with him. I had seen him at clubs. I used to see him at Smoke every now and then. And he always struck me as someone who was paying attention to the elders and kind of engaging with them, listening to them, and in many cases, creating opportunities for himself to learn from them. And so those are two very different ways of seeing Emmett Cohen, I think, because the thing at the Rubin Museum for that competition was ultimately about the pianism of mm-hmm. what he does.
Right.
You know, and I felt that I had a pretty good idea that he was somebody who was a good translator of this music for a wide audience. And I think it was proven when he caught fire during the pandemic with yeah. Emmett's Place.
Yeah, you know, there's an intangible with him, and I think, you know, you hear it in conversation as much as you hear it in his music. He's one of those people with a very easygoing charisma, you know?
But he's shrewd too.
Oh, there's no question. You know, he's a very, very savvy artist and, you know, this is not a dig, but he's a savvy operator.
Absolutely.
Like he's very aware of marketing and positioning and messaging, right? But my fundamental point is that, you know, he's somebody who understands the good feeling, you know, and how integral that is to the music getting over, you know. You can be playing the hippest and most advanced stuff, and if it doesn't open a door for people somewhere, if there's no way in, then, you know, you've lost your connection. And so he really, I think, gets that both on an intuitive level and then also on an intellectual level. I think he has thought about it, but I also think that's who he is.
Yeah, I think he values engagement.
Right.
And being with the audience in some way.
Well, that seems like as good a segue as we're going to get. So why don't we jump into our conversation with Emmett Cohen?
Here at WRTI. Emmett Cohen joins us here on The Late Set, and it's a pleasure to have you. You're touring with Miles and Coltrane at 100 this year. You also have a new recording called Universal Truth. And first of all, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to see you guys.
And, you know, one of the things I've always loved about your career, man, is that you went to seek a lot of universal truth. And what I mean by that, it may be a different universal truth from your recording, but you actively sought out the masters. And for instance, Albert Tudy Heath and George Coleman and Ron Carter, you know, there's a lot of lessons to be learned in things like that. And I'm curious how that stuff both influences your treatment of playing Miles and Coltrane's music when you're talking to people like Tudy who played with them, and also how it has sort of informed this recording in some sense.
Yeah, I think Universal Truth to me is about asking questions. And that's what John Coltrane was going for. He was like, what are the bigger questions in life? What does this mean? What does this all mean? How can I connect what I'm doing physically on this earth to whatever the higher power is, whatever the unity is, whatever the whatever's out there? And I think that's the thing that I glean from all the jazz masters. They've lived this whole life and played with all these people, and just part of the continuum is asking those questions, like, why are we here? And they all had a different way of dealing with those questions. I mean, Tudy Heath and Jimmy, they would use humor to answer those questions. You know, Ron Carter is very focused and very stoic and very disciplined, and that's another approach to answer the bigger questions. So for me, it was always about trying to experience why they were playing, how they played, you know, what really mattered? What was the essence of what they were going for, and use it to influence the essence of what I'm going for. And that's what this tour and this album is really about. We're celebrating John Coltrane and Miles Davis. But for me, it's about what they represented and how they were kind of going for the same same version of the different things, or different versions of the same thing, whichever way you want to look at it. And, you know, we could just play the tunes, or we could, play our own tunes and celebrate our own artistry in an effort to celebrate their artistry, because that's what maybe they would have wanted. And so there's so many ways to approach it. And, I think that, you know, by staying true to ourselves, that's the universal truth. So, and that's what I learned from being around all the great musicians, young and old. They were just connected to who they are, their individuality, and also how they connected to the whole.
That sort of leads me to a question on the flip side of that title, you know, because the opposite of universal is particular, you know, and you as a musician, of your age group, you have a particular set of references and experience and challenges. You know, the media landscape is different. The record industry landscape is different. The way that audiences interact with the music is different than it was for, you know, these masters that we just named. And so how do you, or how have you sort of triangulated those lessons from the elders with, like, being an artist in this moment, you know, and navigating all of the weirdness and challenges, but also all of the opportunities that exist in this current moment?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head when you said in this current moment. Mm-hmm. And that's how I always try to think about it. It's like, how do we celebrate being here and now? And whether that means it's okay to post a video of us in soundcheck and share that with the world, or it's okay to meditate in silence and just let it be for the people that are for yourself, or the people that are at a show. Those are two separate things, you know, like just sitting still is honoring the moment, and also playing for a group of people and it not having any sort of documentation. That's really important too. And so the landscape is ever changing, and to just honor whatever's right there right now. And I think for them, you know, vinyl and media outlets who decided what albums were supposed to be popular and who got the press. And now it's kind of like the people's decision. You know, if you're doing something and people are liking it, then you follow that thread. And I think that's what it became with Emmett's Place and the live stream. It was like, okay, how do we follow that thing that people seem to be liking, and then start there in that moment? Okay, so then maybe we'll do more of that they liked. Well, maybe then we'll expand in this direction that they might not like. But since we started here, you know, the people might have their ears expanded a little bit. And so we have a little more control over what we want to put out in the world. And instead of making an album every year or 2 years or 3 years, we've been making an album every month, doing a live stream. And that's been cool too, because then it takes the pressure off of, okay, what am I going to do for my next album? Mm-hmm. Now we have so much music out there and people can find it if they want, and that can lead us back to an album. Or maybe we're just going to take a little chunk of that and they can hear one solo that Tavon Pennicott did on something that we posted on our social channels that gets a lot of visibility. But I think the main thing is, how do we make people's lives better and more fulfilled through the music that we all believe in? And that's the goal.
It's funny. Josh and I have been talking a lot about the history of Prestige Records, because it's a big anniversary year for that. And there's a beautiful art book out. And there's also a book about, you know, the history of that. And as you're talking, it makes me think about the fact that, you know, a lot of those albums were, you know, musicians would just kind of roll in and play the thing, and that was it. That was the record, you know? And the historical record that you're talking about, the body of work that just keeps building of these sessions, you know, it's a moment in time. It's a snapshot, but it can live, you know, as long as our systems do, you know, like, yeah. It's all there accumulated, and somebody could lose a couple of weeks just like catching up on your recorded archive, which is amazing.
Yeah, I think that there's so much diversity in it as well. And this is something we talked about before, but we have a legendary musician like Joshua Redman, and all of a sudden we pair him with an up-and-coming musician who's just finished rehearsal at Juilliard, popped down the street, and we met at the live stream during the tune, and her name is Skylar Tang. She played an amazing thing, and people in our community started to talk about her and ask about her and follow her now. There's that. And then a couple of years ago, we had Sheila Jordan on our live stream and Russell Malone on our live stream, and they're no longer with us. And so that's like a document of these legendary musicians in a really challenging time in world history, that happens to be one of the last things that they put out in the world. So we have musicians whose first thing that people are discovering them here, and then this musicians who the last thing, and everything in between. That's just, you know, two examples.
With as many episodes of Emmett's Place as you've had, you have also branched beyond the immediate community, the jazz community, and you've opened it up to some other perspectives. Like, do you have a good example of that or a story to tell?
Yeah. In one of the most recent Emmett's Place episodes, I invited a Broadway and TV star named Jordan Fisher to come join us. And I didn't know if he was going to show up. And he showed up and kind of really went outside his comfort zone, sat in with our band, and we came up with a couple of standards. He said, I met him, I think when I was doing a Josh Groban fundraiser, and Josh sang Pure Imagination, and he's like, I want to play that with you, you know, just like Josh did. And I said, well, let's make it happen on the live stream. And so he came and we did that. And it was just a magical moment, like combining different worlds. Mm-hmm. And I think he'd been many times in Power Station to do cast recordings and things like that. So there's so much continuity, but I don't think really my audience knew anything about him beforehand. So we were able to cross-pollinate in that way. And it was just a beautiful moment of like, okay, we're going to meet where we are. And it might have very little to do with jazz, but it might have everything to do with it, depending on who's listening and analyzing. And I love that, where it's really just open to interpretation.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination.
As you said, the people get to decide now, and you're building such a substantial archive that they get to sort of navigate that, as you've recognized. I want to refer to something that you mentioned Tutti Heath saying to you when you asked him, how can you be involved in this for so long, so many decades, and the recognition that it is about the relationships. So I want to translate that to your audience development strategy. And how do you build these relationships with your audience? How do you engage with them? And, you know, where do you want to lead them? It's not a free-for-all, mm-hmm. you know, but where do you want them to go? And what do you want them to take away?
I think any relationship is built around trust. And I think that we built some sort of trust with the consistency that we streamed during the pandemic, and dedicating ourselves to you know, I joke about it, like risking our lives to you know, in that time we were getting together in our little bubble in Harlem, which is a place where during Prohibition people came together when there were rules and regulations against it, and had drinks and played music because that's what the world needed. And we discovered that that's what the world needed. in that first week of the pandemic in 2020, we were like, what do we do best? How can we help? You know, we play. That's what we know how to do. That's what Russell Hall said. And I said, yeah, you're right. We got to play. And so I think that there was some trust built there. And, you know, to be consistent, to show up to all the places that we show up, to go to Colorado once a year, go to, you know, all over California once a year, go to Detroit and Miami and all these places, go to Europe, you know, once a year and, you know, bring something new, bring someone new, that they can learn, about, come with some new music or come with some stuff that we did in the past that we're revisiting. And so I think the audience relationship always starts with the music. What are you bringing and, how digestible is it? You know, this is a hard world too, where we're bombarded with news and updates and push notifications, and there's so many things to know about and keep up with, and you know, to have some music that's able to be digested and bring some joy and counters that I think is really important for this era as well. You know, people their minds are full in other places. So where can we take those full minds and massage them or soothe them in a way, and then begin to expand from there? I think is always something that I think about the audience relationship. Like, and what would make someone tell their friends they need to see this show? You know, what would send people back to see us 10 times, 20 times over the last 10 years? And I think it starts from here and really digging deep in here in order to build that trust. Like, we're always going to play from our hearts, and it's always going to be, like the last thing we ever did. You know, it's going to feel like that. Like, this could be the last time we're ever playing. This could, be, you know, the last time we're connecting with you guys.
Like, for all we know.
Yeah, right? We may never meet again. And start from that love, start from that gratitude, and then build outwards and expand outwards from that place.
Are you concerned about AI, or do you think it's never gonna recreate this thing?
I'm really concerned about it.
Yeah.
I think I've dedicated a lot of time in the last year or so to seeing how it can help what we do,
yeah.
How it can... not musically maybe, but all the things around it.
Yeah. What kind of conclusions are you coming to, or wow. You've come to?
Well, just that there are tools that everyone's going to be using. And if you're not using them, then, it's going to be really hard to keep up, whether it's with the media side, whether it's the social media side. And also that this human connection and this live music thing is going to be more important than ever. And to figure out how to keep that going in the most powerful way, whether it's online or whether it's in person or with these connections, that we've been making all over the internet or radio or any of these places. And we just have to remember that comes first, and the things that are surrounding humanity are going to be even more sought after. So use the tools to help us keep that humanity. I think that's the main thing. But it's been easy. It's easier than ever to build a website or,
sure.
You know, or write a bio. We were sitting backstage with Jeremy Pelt the other night, and I said, yeah, Mr. Pelt, you ever use AI for anything? He said, I never used it. And I just, you know, opened Claude and I asked it to take everything from the internet that it knows about Jeremy Pelt and create a two paragraph bio as if he was going to be appearing at Carnegie Hall. And I mean, he was astonished at what he was like, I needed a new bio. Yeah. And so those kinds of things can help an independent artist like that. Whereas they might've had to hire someone or spend a week to do it before, which is bad for the people that they were hiring, which might've been you, Nate. But I think it's just the world is readjusting and evolving, and we're evolving with it in the best way that we know how, and try to preserve this thing.
Yeah.
Well, that human connection, you know, it makes me think about people in a room, right? And the power of Emmett's Place, I think, you know, one of the things you know, aside from the musicianship and all of the joy that you exude and the hospitality that you embody, but it's the feeling of the room, you know, which even if you're not in the room and you're watching a stream from halfway across the world, you can sense that, you know. And there's all these rooms that have opened, you know, in the last few years. I feel like since the end of pandemic restrictions, I haven't been in a space with live jazz that wasn't alive, you know, like people are really seeking it out. And that leads me to sort of a question about the aliveness of what I will call, for lack of a better term, like straight ahead jazz, you know, among a younger generation, among listeners who are younger than any of us, it feels like there's just this fantastic energy and enthusiasm around it. And you are out there on the front lines. So I want you to confirm this impression or correct me. But like, it seems like a really hopeful time for music that has that spirit.
Yeah, that's a really hard thing to try to go back in time and try to analyze why and how it got here. But I think by spending time with the jazz masters and playing with Benny Golson, you know, he might be on stage, play his compositions, then he plays Now's the Time by Charlie Parker and Confirmation. And then I play with Jimmy Cobb and he wants to play Autumn Leaves and On Green Dolphin Street. And then I play with Ron Carter and he wants to, you know, he wants to play an F blues and right down the middle. And I was, you know, then you go to a jazz school curriculum and they're like, well, you need to take composition and arranging and you know, we want you to invert this thing. And I went to study, I got a master's at Manhattan School of Music and the program was called A Chromatic Approach to Improvisation by Dave Liebman. And I'm just learning about all these things. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm able to make my own discernment. Like when we play Autumn Leaves with Jimmy Cobb, like that's the thing that I connected with most. And I think we then brought that to when we toured and we played. And even when we're doing this Miles and Train tribute, there's one slot in the show every night that that I'll pick a different song that they played. And sometimes it's Stella by Starlight. And Tavon in particular, you know, remarked to me like, you know, I couldn't imagine like playing for 12 or 1500 people that we would just, you know, take a moment to just play a standard. And that's what really the live stream is about. And I think the visibility of that kind of gave a younger audience permission to be like, oh no, that's a fine thing to go ahead and do. And so there's been permission given to do that again. And like we talked about before, it's the people's choice now. So do people want to actually hear a chromatic approach to improvisation after they worked 5 days, 9 to 6 p.m., and this is their Friday night? Or do they want to hear something they might recognize, but in a very current, modern, modern is the operative word here. Like, what is modern? But, you know, my argument is modern is right now, modern is genius. You hear Art Tatum or Thelonious Monk, that sounds modern to me. You know, but really, it for me, it can mean, you know, genius or everlasting, or it can mean just like modern is here right now. Whatever we're doing is going to be modern. So that's a word that's been hijacked a little bit too. But I think that, but there's been a lot of permission given, and it's sprouted up in the '90s too with the Young Lions, and Joshua Redman and Christian McBride and Brad Meldow and all the explosion, Roy Hargrove and all that came from that time too. People were really invigorated by that. And a lot of it's cyclical, but I think we're in a time now where people are really appreciating the feeling of swing and that it's okay to start there with something that may have been perceived as obvious before, but now with a new light shown on it is like, wow, it's actually really hard to just play a song and make it come alive and be free on it and treat it in a modern context, even though it's still swinging. So it's a lot of syntax and a lot of like, how are you going to describe, you know, jargon and things like that. But that's a take on it.
So let's talk about universal truth. What are you discovering as universal truths after all of this receiving of information? And, you know, what are you trying to say to your audience with this recording?
I think it's directly related to the last thing we were just talking about. And the universal truth is that everything is up to whatever your perception is. And it's about asking those questions like, you know, what is it all about? Who is this all for? You know, what's actually important? You know, is an AI race learning about that important? Is it important just to read a book? And, you know, these are like questions that we have to ask ourselves every day. And that it exists in the music too. And I think that by sharing that concept, we can just get people thinking a little more about, you know, what to truly do with their time on earth, and what to truly believe about why and how we're all here together and how we should interact with everyone else. And, you know, the more I think about the universal truth, it's like, you know, what can I do for somebody else? What can I do for others, to brighten their experience here? And then how that shines back on me. And I hear that in the work of John Coltrane and Miles Davis, who we're celebrating. But I also hear that in a lot of the great artists that changed the scope of American art or world's history or anything like that.
The moment is always now.
Yeah, the moment is always now.
And you can build a sustained engagement with moments over the course of however you are here, however long you are here on Earth.
And it's about figuring out who you are and who you want to be, and being okay to evolve as well. Who I was 15 years ago when I met you, Nate, is I had really different views about music and why I was doing this. It was more just doing, and now it's a lot more thinking about why and you know, being able to assess the journey of not only me but to look at the people that I've known and played with for 10, 15, 20 years almost, and see ourselves as mirrors and see the great artists that I look up to in jazz history and see myself through them in a different place every decade. And I think it's just about all of that coming together and then just kind of being in the moment and celebrating like with gratitude, like, wow, I get to play the piano and that's amazing. Not everyone has that experience and that opportunity. And so approaching it like that.
In that spirit, is if you turn around right now at this piano, what is calling to you? What is the song or the theme that emerges out of this conversation?
Oh my God.
Without overthinking it, just like...
Just turn around?
Yeah.
Like what? Well, we just did a recording session here in the studio and I just have this theme that I wrote going over and over again. And it's, Tavon Pennicott plays it in the show and just the way he phrases it, it just gets stuck in my head. It's a melody that I created, but he brought it to life. So just this kind of haunting melody that ends up on this vamp and it has a landing spot. And that was just really in my head and the way he plays it. And we just went over it a few times and the different ways of getting in and out of it. That was just in my head right now. And that's that, since we're talking about universal truth, that's a tune of mine called Eternal Glimpse.
And it's the first of this suite that you and Tavon are performing here at WRTI, also Compassion, and then the title track, Universal Truth. You composed this as a singular suite?
Yeah, it was something that I sat down and wanted to really honor how John Coltrane and Miles Davis felt in my body, you know, and it's really, you could take it in any direction to honor such great and influential musicians. And so I really had to take a step back and I'm like, well, what do they mean to me? that's the only way I'm going to be able to come up with something. And so it makes me think of them, but it also makes me think of everything beyond them. And it's in my body and it's in my mind, and hopefully it's available for everyone to access to when we play it.
These were two very different individuals.
Yeah.
You know, two of our greatest artists, but, you know, and it's amazing that they, you know, were on the same bandstand and in the same studios for as long as they were and left us this body of work. But when I think about what unites the two of them most, you know, because they were so temperamentally opposites in a lot of ways, the thing I think of is transformation. You know, neither of them really stood still for very long in their artistic evolution. And I wonder if that's something that appeals to you too.
Yeah, I love to track where they started individually, where they intersected in the 50s, and then where they departed to on their own journeys and with their own bands and conceptions. That's really fascinating to me. And so I think a lot of how we celebrate them is to celebrate our own artistry and not being afraid to go in a certain direction. But I also love to really hit that intersection point where they did play together and the music that they did create and how their sound blend and then how different they become, but how you can still hear the thread of who they are within that. And it makes us as musicians really okay with being who we are and being available to change and being available to be right where we are in the moment. I think there's a lot of pressure as an artist today to come out with the next thing or you know, show us what your next project is or how you're going to talk about it. And that's not something that I think they were concerned with. They just did it. You know, they just did what they wanted to do in the moment. And it kind of gives us permission and freedom a little bit to just be here and do what we want to do and what we're called to do without having to worry about it too much, because it's a lot of anxiety these days, especially with short form content and how we're going to, you know, make it all work. And they remind me that you're able to take your time. You're able to eat one bite at a time and grow one step at a time.
A lot of what you have just recognized is that there's a certain itinerancy to the life of a musician. And, you know, some things last, some things happen. Two roads diverge in a wood in some sense occasionally, and then reconnect many years later. I'm curious, from your perspective, we've talked about the itinerancy, but what lasts? What are the things that last? What are also the things that last for the people who are no longer here that you have had moments with?
Yeah, the things that last are those unforgettable moments, I think, those feelings. You know, they say you never remember exactly what someone said, but you remember how they made you feel. Mm-hmm. When I used to study with my mentor, Shelley Berg, he said, you know, he'd always say, you know, the best compliment you can get as a musician is someone coming up to you afterwards and saying, like, you know, when you guys did that in the music, I'll remember that forever. And that, you know, that'll stick with me, you know, forever. That made me think of such and such in my life. And I hadn't thought of that in so many years. And so, you know, those kinds of things that have deeper connection. It's about connection, really. Those are the things that last through generations. And, you know, nobody knows their great-grandparents' names hardly anymore these days, right? But you know, if you can name all four of your great-grandparents' names, then you win some kind of award. but whatever they stood for is passed down through your grandparents and through your parents and lives in you. And I think that's important to remember. So whatever you do here is going to affect people for generations to come. And
one thought can produce a million vibrations.
Right.
The words of John Coltrane.
Right. I mean, it all goes right back to them. And so I think that's a really important thing to remember when you're moving around your life. If you think no one's listening, or you can't really find where you fit in, you know, there's probably something that you're doing that's affecting at least one person or a handful of people. You know, even if one person connects with your music and you heal them through what you wrote or what you played, you know, that's enough to make a really big difference in the world. And some positivity and some love.
Well, that's a really generous and generative kind of perspective. And I think it makes a lot of sense coming from you. That feeling, you know, creating and imparting that feeling, like that's something I always associate with your music, kind of whatever you're playing, you know, just like radiating, you know, just the joy and good vibes, you know, the vibe provider, as you said.
Yeah, that was the nickname of one of my dear friends, Fumi Ononaye.
Oh yeah.
And he was like, you know, the jazz scene, it extends beyond the musicians a lot of times. It's people who need the music, who hang out with the musicians. And Fumi was a great jazz fan and DJ and did some A&R, ended up working for Wynton Marsalis at the end of his life. After all the live stream stuff, he helped kind of curate and was there providing the vibe. And they always said we walked into a room, he was able to provide that, that feeling that you can't really put a finger on. And that's something that we do as musicians. He was able to just do it with his energy.
Mm-hmm.
And he taught me a lot about energy and how to share and how to conserve and when to open and how to open up to people and how to get them to open up as well.
Well, thank you for opening up with us today here and Miles and Coltrane at 100 and Universal Truth and Emmett's Place and so much more. We appreciate your time here on the Late Set.
Thank you so much. Nice to be here. Thanks, Nate.
Yeah, man.
Josh.
And that's our conversation with Emmett Cohen. We're happy to have him in the WRTI studio a couple of months ago. And he brought Tavon Pennicott with him, and they did some performances. You can check that out at WRTI Music, our account on YouTube. And thank you for listening to this conversation. I mean, he's still providing the vibes, man.
That he is. And, you know, I like, as we said, I like that he took the opportunity of, you know, this centennial year for Miles Davis and John Coltrane and said, all right, we can put together a celebration of this music that people are going to love. But I'm also going to create a musical statement of my own that kind of, you know, bounces off of those two giants and says something that I want to say. You know, it feels like a smart way of, you know, taking the centennial and not just saying, oh, we're going to play a bunch of music that people like.
Yeah, it's not populism for its own sake. I mean, I guess populism as it relates to jazz audiences and Miles Davis and John Coltrane being some significant figures in our music. But yeah, like you said, just acknowledging and respecting that and also saying, yeah, I have something to contribute here too. Sometimes it's the vibe, sometimes it's the music, sometimes it's the shirt, sometimes it's the atmosphere of people being together in a space and having a hang. You know, I just think that all of those things sort of fall off of the, naturally are a part of this music,
mm-hmm.
You know.
People coming together.
Yeah, people coming together and, you know, having a thing.
Well, Speaking of having a thing, we have a thing here on the Late Set.
Yeah.
We call it This I Dig.
Nate, I'm going to give you something that I'm still digging. It's really just a matter of appreciation at this point, because I'm going to talk to you a little bit about things that have already happened as it relates to the Phillies, because I watch baseball a lot.
Sure.
I watch Phillies games a lot. And I just want to acknowledge the incredible run that... Sorry, I'm so tired. I'm forgetting his fucking name. I got it now. I just want to acknowledge the incredible run that Christopher Sanchez has had as the pitcher of the Philadelphia Phillies, especially during the month of May, where he threw an entire month and did not give up a run at all. He threw over 50 innings of scoreless baseball in a row, which is phenomenal. I mean, I can't. I remember as a kid when Oral Hershiser did it for the Dodgers.
Yeah.
And I think before that it might have been Don Drysdale. There weren't a lot of people on this list, and especially left-handers. And Christopher Sanchez is left-handed. He's really a phenomenal pitcher. I say all this because recently, you know, he's human, and he fell a little bit, and he gave up some runs. But overall, he is really the ace of the Phillies these days, and that's saying something because Wheeler is an incredible pitcher. So we're blessed on the mound here in Philadelphia for great pitching, and I just wanted to give a nod of acknowledgement to what Christopher Sanchez has done for the sport, and it's been a joy to watch, and I mean, for almost 6-7 weeks, he was just dominating people. The best part is he only has a handful of pitches, and his best pitch is the changeup. And everyone knows it's coming, and they still can't hit it. And that, to me, is a mark of a really incredible pitcher. Now, right now, before the All-Star break and everything, which the All-Star game is happening here in Philly, there's talk about, will it be him or will it be this young ace for the Milwaukee Brewers? They call him the Miz. Nobody beats the Miz, Jacob Mizorowski, who throws like 104 miles an hour and throws consistently at 100 the entire game. He's got the fastball. It's got incredible run. You know, he's his own thing that is remarkable. But Sanchez is a very different kind of pitcher. It's more really calculating, and like it gets in batters' heads and stuff like that. And like I said, the fact that they all know it's coming and they still can't hit it, to me, is remarkable. So I hope to see him start the All-Star game here in Philadelphia. And if not, I mean, Philly may burn this place down.
Well, I will stick with music for my recommendation this week.
All right, good for you.
If you're listening to this episode, you know, the week that it comes out, this is also the release week for a really great album by a saxophonist named Alden Hellmuth. Are you familiar with her?
Yeah, we're playing it on the radio at WRTI, man.
There we go. This is a young saxophonist originally from Hartford, Connecticut, and attended the Hart School. I don't think she had any overlap with the great Jackie McLean. I think he was already gone by the time she was there. But, you know, his aura and his legacy still resides in that institution and in that community. And so as primarily an alto saxophonist, I think she very much sees herself in that lineage. This album is called Tether, and she did some really interesting things on it. She enlisted two bassists, Logan Kane and Miller Wren. These are Los Angeles cats that I don't really know. And then Justin Brown, the drummer who we know from Amber Sakonmusari and Thundercat and Aja Monet, Flying Lotus, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And so it's this album that really balances a kind of, you know, sort of awareness of electronic music and experimental ambient music and maybe a little bit of hip hop. But she also draws inspiration from things like Anthony Braxton's ghost trance music, you know? Like she's really like thinking in a sort of open-minded and almost like a magpie kind of way, you know, like what can I take from this? What can I take from this? It's really interesting album. And I think it's an exciting next step for her. And she's somebody that I've just got my ear tilted toward at the moment.
All right.
The Late Set is a production of WRTI and made possible by WRTI members. Enjoy this podcast? Of course you are. Leave us a rating on the podcast platform of your choice and be sure to subscribe and follow us on social media. Our handle is WRTI Music. Our email is editor@WRTI.org. That goes right to me. Be nice.
Our show is hosted by Nate Chenin and me, Josh Jackson, and produced by Alex Arif. Robbie Webb is our assistant production manager. He mixed this episode. Jacob Dodd was our production assistant and helped us to record the Emmett interview and in-studio performance. Be sure to head to WRTI's YouTube channel where you can watch that performance. A stripped down, not them, duo version of Emmett's Universal Truth Suite, featuring saxophonist Tavon Pennicott.
Our director of operations and production is Tyler McClure. Associate general manager for content and programming is Josh Jackson. And Bill Johnson is WRTI's general manager. Stop by WRTI.org to see everything else we've got cooking up here in Philadelphia and beyond. We'll see you soon.